Senate Judiciary Committee, Wednesday, February 6, 1991.
On the types of punishment that you could impose for contempt, and said at least with respect to the Supreme Court, that you could not limit that power, that that was an inherent power.
Okay, Madam Chair, well, whether we specified in Section 8 the maximum allowed penalty is 30 days, or we write it as you have in Section 9, still the outcome is the same. We can make the statement, and you're saying the courts will determine whether or not we have a valid ability to do that.
Senator Bunn, I think that's the case with all the legislation we pass out of here.
I'm just trying to clarify that we didn't leave a loophole, that in fact, as far as we're concerned, we have stated the maximum penalty for as far as incarceration is 30 days under summary contempt. So we've made whatever attempt we can to set a limit, whether or not that holds. That is written in, as I understand it.
And I would assume, and I would add on to this and check that, I'm assuming also that if a judge decided to go beyond that, that they would, you know, that they'd have to justify it on their own powers as defined on 22 and as inherent, that they can allege their own inherent power, whatever that is, and somebody at that point, the case goes on up and goes.
Okay, but then it would not be more effective for us to, well, I think we do say it, not more than 30 days, it's there. So if we have such ability, we've exercised the ability. Okay. Then the other question I had in the area of the summary imposition, I looked at one of the drafts that clearly stated, and it's the language has been changed before it reached us now, but has no right to counsel, no right to bail, no right to jury trial, has only those rights to refuse afforded in a civil trial, and no right to file an affidavit seeking referral to another judge. That language has been removed, but in fact, aren't those conditions existent? I mean, don't those conditions still exist in the bill by silence, if nothing else?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, that is what the cases basically say is the rule with respect to imposition of quote-unquote for direct contempt, that you do not have those rights in those situations.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions while we're stopped before we urge Dave to go ahead then? Okay. Please.
Having taken that detour back to Section 8, it probably makes sense to go back to the beginning now and work our way through, bearing in mind that none of what I say from here on out really applies to that situation already described of a direct contempt. We're talking about situations occurring outside of the presence of the court or situations where contempt sanctions are being imposed other than for the purpose of maintaining order in the court. Section 1 defines contempt of court very broadly. It's the language that is derived from the Wisconsin statute. Under the existing statutory scheme, Chapter 33, there's a list of about 10 separate items that are designated to be contempt of court. Beyond that, there are many, many statutory provisions that says if you do this, it shall be contempt of court. The intent in putting in subsection 2, as I understand it, was not to anyhow limit the situations for which a court can impose a sanction for contempt of court. It was merely intended to more broadly define, if anything, the powers, not to expand or to contract the power to impose a sanction. Section 2 has the statement previously referred to, that the power to impose a remedial or punitive sanction is an inherent judicial power. Sections 1 to 14 of this Act establish procedure to govern the exercise of that power. That is a provision that's near and dear to most judges' hearts, I think. I think most judges feel it is an inherent power. There's a lot of case law on inherent power, including some very recent case law from last year. as to what the extent of that judicial power is at this point. I won't go into that at that point unless there's some interest in that. Subsection 2 of Section 2 merely states the rule with respect to exercising contempt powers against corporations. It says basically if you're an officer, director, or other person, you can be held in contempt for the acts of the corporation the same as if you were a defendant in the contempt proceeding. Again, a very short section to deal with it. One of the attempts in putting this together was not to try to deal with every single conceivable circumstance that might arise, so a lot of it is in fairly broad language. Section 3 basically sets out the rules on how court-appointed counsel would be paid under the Act. Basically incorporates the same provisions now provided for appointed counsel in criminal cases, both at the state court level and at the justice court, municipal court, or other public body, if another public body is seeking the imposition of the contempt charge. So it doesn't really change.
Okay, I'm not sure that my questions are directed at the right time, but because we deal with things like counsel in each of the different sections, if I could, I'll just bring up a question to clarify that.
Sure.
Under our right to counsel, under summary judgment, you said there is no right to counsel, but under remedial and criminal contempt, the right to counsel, it does not exist in the first 30-day question for remedial. Does it exist if someone may only be sentenced for 30 days in the criminal, 29 days?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I believe that the way it's drafted, the way the language came down as far as punitive sanction, it's at the bottom of page 3 under the procedure for imposition of punitive sanctions, the last sentence. The defendant is entitled to the Constitution and statutory protections, including the right to court-appointed counsel, that a defendant would be entitled to.
I'm sorry, I didn't find that section. Where are you?
It's on page 3, starting sub 6 of section 6.
Okay.
The very bottom, and then he's going on to the top of page 4.
Thank you.
Basically, it indicates you have the same right to court-appointed counsel that you would be entitled to in a criminal proceeding in which the fine or term of imprisonment that can be imposed is equivalent to the punitive sanction sought in the contempt proceeding.
Okay. So in the question of the criminal or punitive contempt, then the individual has all the rights of any other criminal trial except trial by jury.
Senator Cohen, or Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, yes, that's the general way it's laid out. It's exactly as if you were in a criminal proceeding in which the fine or term of imprisonment that is being sought was one that was being brought underneath a crime, a criminal charge.
Thank you.
Any other?
Not yet.
Carry on. That's good. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, please, Dave.
Section 4 fleshes out the concept of punitive versus remedial sanctions. Much of the language that is in this section is derived almost directly from the Fiat case. They were very, as I said, it was a very clear decision. It said, here's what we mean by a punitive sanction. And it said, and the important thing to note under Section 4 is that confinement, sending someone to jail, can be either a remedial or punitive sanction. Just because you're going to jail doesn't mean it's a punitive sanction. And you're going to get all the rights that are built in to that punitive provision. They indicate that it's remedial if that confinement continues or accumulates until the defendant complies with the court order or judgment. And I think maybe an easy example of that is the person refuses to testify. The person comes before the court. They do not have a Fifth Amendment right not to testify. The court is entitled to have that person testify, and the court says, go to jail until you testify. That even though you're going to jail, is clearly, under the bill, a remedial sanction. And that is basically the rule that was laid down in the Fiat case. So the fact that you're going to jail alone doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to get the protections or the procedures provided for punitive. You have to look to why you are going to jail. What's the purpose of the confinement? Indicates that it's punitive. The confinement will be punitive if it is for a definite period. That's the clear example where you bring somebody in, you're talking past behavior, you did something you weren't supposed to do, and the judge says go to jail for 30 days. This is a punitive assessment. At that point, you're looking at a punitive sanction, and you better make sure that you're following the correct procedure underneath the section for imposition of punitive sanctions.
Madam Chair, if we dealt with the remedial sanctions and set an outer limit on what we would accept as far as a time period, that doesn't make it by the fact that there's a definite maximum punitive, does it?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, if your question is whether or not we have somehow made a remedial sanction into a punitive one by saying that the maximum that can be imposed is 6 months, no, I don't think that is going to have the effect.
So as long as it's clear that during the point of sanction, if the person complies, the sanction has ended, it is remedial, and the fact that we may set a 6 month or a 2 year limit on how long that sanction could continue would not cause a problem as far as changing the definition of what kind of a sanction it was.
That is correct, Senator. The cases always talk about remedial sanctions where you're going to jail as being situations where you have the key to your prison door in your own pocket. That's a little loose, and I can think of cases where maybe that wouldn't be so applicable. But the bottom line is that in remedial-type sanctions, they have to be, if you're going to send them to jail, they have to be subject to termination by the person in jail by taking some act, whether it be paying some amount, testifying, whatever it is that the court has found you in contempt for.
Thank you.
Returning to Section 4, fines as well can be remedial or punitive, and the Supreme Court indicated that in the case as well. It's punitive if it's for past contempt. If it's a discrete act that's occurred in the past and you say pay $500, it's a punitive fine. If it's remedial under the Act and under the Fiat case, if it's for continuing contempt, then the fine accumulates until the defendant complies with the court's judgment or order. That's the case where the judge says, pay $50 a day until, if you don't comply with my order, you're going to pay $50 a day. And until you do, that's going to accumulate. And at that point, even though it may look like a fine, it will be treated as a remedial sanction under the Act. And in those cases, you do not need to go through the punitive procedure to impose that type of fine. Subsection 5 of Section 4 is one that counsel brought to my attention before this hearing, and it may not be, I'm not sure it's totally correct, and this is a policy one. I'll probably defer to Bill on this one. It indicates that any sanction imposed by a court for contempt is in addition to any civil remedy or criminal sanction that may be available. My review of that, of the question there, there may be double jeopardy issues with that sentence. I think after looking at the state cases that have come down, I believe counsel may be correct that if you impose a punitive sanction, you've basically gone through a criminal procedure and imposed a sanction, it may not be possible to bring a criminal charge on that same activity that gave rise to the contempt charge. That's a small category of all the possible situations that may arise under subsection 5, but I believe that that's probably a good point. It may be something that needs to be returned to. Section 5 lays out the procedure for imposing remedial sanctions. This is the how you go about it if you want to get the sanction imposed against a person and you have determined that what you're looking for is one of these remedial sanctions. This one does change the procedure in some fairly substantial ways from the existing statutory framework. It basically allows the procedure to be commenced by filing of a motion requesting an order that the defendant be ordered to appear. This is quite a bit different from what's in the statute now, since under the existing statute, the court can preemptorily issue an order of arrest for whatever kind of contempt. And this one, as drafted, Section 5, would not allow an arrest warrant for remedial sanction. It would have to be commenced by filing of a motion and service of that motion by personal service on the defendant. The section indicates that you have no right to a jury trial in for imposition of remedial sanctions. That follows the rule that was laid out in FEOC. It basically says if it's a remedial sanction, you can treat it as though it was a civil matter. You have no right to a jury trial. It then goes on in subsection 7 to indicate that the defendant in this action has only those rights accorded to a defendant in a civil action. So what that means is essentially you don't get those rights that are available to you in a criminal procedure. You don't have the right to cross-examine. You don't have the right to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Any of those other rights that come to you if you were charged with a crime. You have a right to be represented by counsel, but except as specifically indicated in subsection 8 and subsection 9, you only have a right to appointment of counsel if you are an indigent in the event that the remedial sanction is going to be for more than 30 days. Subsection 9 is drafted, basically indicates that if you've already been in for 30 days, going back to the example I gave before where you have a refusal to testify, and so go to jail until you're willing to testify. If at the time that person came in it was an indigent, he would have no right to have appointed counsel at the point he first comes before the court. If he could afford an attorney, he could retain one and be represented, but the court won't appoint one for him. If after 30 days he's still in jail and still refusing to talk and still indigent, he will have to be brought back before the court, and at that point he will have to have an attorney appointed to represent him. Now what that attorney would do at that point is not clear. I suppose he could talk to him and explain to him his situation. But basically, I do not see where this would mean that we would have to go through any additional proceedings at that point, at least not the way I read subsection 9.
Madam Chair. Okay, so the proceedings will have taken place that determines that incarceration begins. And you're saying that that can take place without a right to counsel, and then once you've been incarcerated for 30 days, you have a right to counsel, but you don't have a right to revisit what brought about the incarceration.
The way I read it right now, I believe that it certainly doesn't say anything beyond that in this. It doesn't say, for instance, at that point, proceedings shall be recommence to determine with the appointed counsel whether or not this sanction should be imposed.
Okay, and under remedial, there is no limit on how long someone can be incarcerated. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn,
it could be 2 years, 3 years.
Well, to tell you the truth, there's some dispute under the sanctions provisions of this bill whether or not you can. Maybe I should go to that since you raised it at this point.
Well, first I'll come back to one other thing a little bit tied to it. Is it possible under this bill to incarcerate someone for 29 days? You've got a reporter who won't reveal their source, and they happen to be indigent. You incarcerate them for 29 days, then you bring them back, say, are you ready to do that again? Or every 29 days, out a day, back for 29?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, no. I believe that it was drafted clearly enough that after you have spent 30 days in confinement, you have the right to to appointed counsel by bringing him back in and saying this is a new contempt, I don't think you can avoid the requirement of appointing counsel after you've been in jail for 30 days.
Okay, so at this point, you've got your counsel, but you haven't revisited the initial hearing to determine that you're going to go to jail. Then I would appreciate your information on how long it can go on.
Well, as far as how long you can do a remedial sanction?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would take us down to Section 9, which is the section that deals with what sanctions are authorized under the bill. And the first subsection of that section indicates what sanctions may be imposed or in the way of a remedial sanction. Paragraph B indicates that it can be confinement for so long as the contempt continues, or 6 months, whichever is the shorter period. If you look down to subsection or paragraph F of that subsection, which is on page 5 at line 9, there's an additional category of sanctions that can be imposed, which indicates that a sanction other than the sanction specified in paragraphs A to E of this subsection may be imposed if the court determines that the sanction would be an effective remedy for the contempt. To tell you the truth, I had always thought that that authorized some additional period of confinement, but in the last meeting that I attended of the committee, Judge Lipscomb indicated clearly to me that it was his impression that F was not intended to override the six-month period, that you couldn't say, I'm going to now rely on F and impose additional. Now, that's something that's a policy decision, and it could certainly be drafted to make it very clear that if 6 months is the maximum, that's what it will be.
Okay, so then to do that in F on page 5, at line 9, we would simply need to state, however, these additional or other sanctions do not include additional incarceration. Okay, well, I think that would take care of a great deal of my concern about the ability to have an indefinite sentence. But the other question, each separate contempt of court. Okay, an example, I think the example that I've seen the most is the abortion protesters in Portland. They come before a judge. The judge says, you'll sign a statement agreeing to stop these protests. The person says, no. You lock them up for 6 months. If there's not a new action on their part, then the judge could not initiate a new, there would not be a separate contempt, would there? So that in order for them to have another 6 months, they would have to go out, protest, be brought in, and start the whole process over.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, that would be correct if the contempt was imposed for a specific act that constituted the contempt. For instance, violating an order about how close you can go to a clinic door.
Okay.
If that was the act and the judge said, I'm holding you in contempt, mind you, at that point, we're probably talking about a punitive procedure. So we're
We're talking about a judge, if I recall the situation, a judge says, you will sign a statement saying you will not violate my restraining order, or whatever the correct term is. Okay, the individual says, no, I won't sign that. I'm not saying I will or will not violate, but I won't sign. You spend 6 months, you come out. Can the judge then again say, sign it, or it's another 6 months, and just continue that? Or would the individual have to create a violation, and then the judge begin the process again by saying, you have violated my restraining order. Now I'm going to order you to sign a statement saying you won't. I'm trying to find out if there's any absolute limits. The example in Washington, D.C., a woman would not tell the court where her child was. She spent 2 years. The Congress set a year and a half limit. What is to stop you from spending your year and a half coming out and going through the same process again? Is our six-month limit an actual limit, or is it 6 months before you start the next 6 months, before you start the next 6 months? And I think we ought to have clear in our own minds what we're doing, whichever direction we choose. that was more a comment than a question, but I need direction to know what we've done when we finish.
Madam Chair, those are the sort of things I'll probably defer to Bill Linden on, because I think you raised some very good questions, Senator Bunn, with respect to what happens if you do try to put a cap on the maximum time that you can impose for remedial sanction. Those are good questions, and obviously there are a lot of different ways you could go. Maybe Bill Linden has some thoughts on those.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, Mr. Hendricks accurately describes where our discussions in committee ended up on this issue, which was Judge Lipscomb summarizing his opinion, which I agreed with, that the 6 months was a point in time at which the sanction for remedial contempt of imprisonment basically ends. But at the same time, everyone on the committee felt strongly that you had to have Section F, which is sort of the catch-all section, because there are situations in which you can run through these lists of possible remedies to the contempt and still end up at the end of it without an effective remedy, without the thing happening or not happening which, you know, got you into this contempt proceeding in the first place. But clearly, putting the 6 months in Section 9 was an attempt to define the outer limit of imprisonment relating to remedial contempt. In the example you described, you could have a person released without signing that agreement. But I'm not sure that at the point of release you wouldn't have merely a continuing contempt, and then I suppose the court could exercise its discretion as to what, if any, effective remedy they thought there was for that continuing contempt.
Okay. So you would view it as, because it's continuing contempt, you've exhausted one portion on that individual case of contempt, and that's the 6 months. You still have the other remedies available. So it's not each incident, it's not a new incident, but it's a continuing incident.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I think that you could construe that example to be a continuing contempt. Now, whether a judge what a judge would decide in that situation was an effective remedy, I can't predict, because it's all going to, you know, hinge on the particulars of the incident. But I think that is one example of something that could be characterized as a continuing contempt.
Are you then saying that we could in fact say you've served your 6 months and now you're going to start paying as part of F? I'm trying to sort out where
Madam
we
Chair.
Think we are, so that we can have a place to kind of begin the debate from, if we are going to have a debate. And I think that's
because I don't think F was saying that once you've served your 6 months, you're free from any responsibility for the contempt.
Right.
But in fact, you have reached the limit. Just as if we put a financial limit and said once you've paid that, you'll pay no more for that contempt. Well, in essence, we're doing that with an incarceration limit, if I understand that.
Madam Chair, you could, again, in the example Senator Bunn raised, you could, at the end of the six-month period, the judge could decide, well, that was not obviously an effective remedy. So now I'm going to fine you an amount not to exceed $500 a day, and we'll see if that results in an effective remedy. So none of the Section 9 sanctions are exclusive. I mean,
it could be a continuing contempt to try to get the person, coerce the person to do the right, to do what was...
to do what the court ordered.
Yeah. I think we're clarified on where we probably are. With the way the drafting is now, I think.
Okay, so I think I understand the intent is, if you've got the woman that says, I will not tell the court where the child is, once that 6 months is up, that ends that one. She will not be incarcerated again for that contempt, although she may pay a lot of penalties. But incarceration is not one of them.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I don't want to suggest that the 6 months is an absolute limit. I don't know that every judge would interpret it that way, and because this is such an inherent power of the judiciary, I'm not sure that we ought to assume.
Well, then I'll come back to my earlier comment on the 30 days, and that is the limit that we as legislators have stated, whether or not the court recognizes that. It's like anything else that we pass.
That's absolutely correct, because you could have a situation where the judge would get down to subsection 9 of section, subsection F of section 9, and they would not be able to think of any effective remedy.
So they go back and they then justify it on their own inherent powers to say, we're going to do this anyway.
However, by passing legislation with this six-month language in there, you've clearly stated what the legislature thinks ought to be the outside marker.
Thank you.
Are we satisfied with where the drafting circumstances are now? Okay. Thank you, David. Thanks for the ability to clarify here.
Picking up where I left off on the procedure for imposition of remedial sanctions, subsection 11 of that section 5 indicates that inability to comply with an order of the court is an affirmative defense. I didn't have time to.
Very limited procedure that you would envision a private prosecutor being appointed because the district attorney declined to bring a case. By way of an example, collectively in Oregon, there are well over 100,000 child support cases on the DHR system that are being enforced by district attorneys and support enforcement division and Department of Justice. In each one of those cases, 12 monthly payments accrues each year for a total of 1.2 million case annual installments, or monthly installments in a given annual time. If there's a failure to pay any one of those, it theoretically leads to a contempt of court. That's a separate instance and count for failure to abide by a court order, that failure to pay that individual installment. For practical reasons and logistical reasons, we cannot possibly collectively with justice file, if 10% of those cases didn't pay in a given month, we could not file 120,000 contempts in a year between us. And so there's necessarily going to be some criteria by which we establish a threshold level at which we will file a contempt and deem that to be an appropriate procedure. And therefore, we're asking that this section be looked at very carefully, because it's our feeling that there should be some articulated standards by which it's appropriate to appoint counsel in lieu of the DA's actions. There may be instances where we're pursuing a remedial contempt and somebody wants to have a punitive contempt brought. We may have an effective wage assignment or garnishment procedure in effect, and it's producing money, but a party or an obligee might want their pound of flesh and want a criminal action begun. We may be prosecuting a criminal action, and I don't think it's clear under the bill that, as for reasons that were alluded to earlier about double jeopardy, whether or not pursuit of a remedial punitive contempt would exclude then subsequent criminal prosecution. Well, what if the criminal prosecution is first and then the remedial contempt, or I'm sorry, punitive contempt is brought, is there double jeopardy? I mean, so there's some issues in here that concern us. What we've asked or proposed in order to get us over, I guess, the hump on this, assuming that it might be appropriate in some rare instances for the court sua sponte to want to bring an action for contempt, we've suggested at least that there be some proviso language that says, provided that other remedies have been shown to be ineffective, then the court may entertain such a request, and we'd like that to be discretionary rather than mandatory. We've also noted that in Section 16, and I think Mr. Linden alluded to this also, that section has traditionally been confined to issues where district attorneys have an inherent conflict of interest. They are related to the accused, they've been in business with the accused, they've represented the accused while in private practice, those types of issues. And for that reason, it's appropriate for the court to appoint a special prosecutor. This is a fairly substantial expansion in that area and an inroad by suggesting now that when the DA, in their discretion, declined to prosecute a case, that suddenly then it's appropriate for the court to step in and say, District Attorney, without any notice of District Attorney, I am going to appoint a private attorney to represent the interests of the private litigant in a criminal proceeding in this particular instance. So we've asked for, if it's deemed appropriate to retain that section, that at least there be a proviso for giving notice to the district attorney in advance, so we have an opportunity to come before the court and show that what remedies we have taken, or what steps we have taken, what remedies may have been effective, and what has been done thus far prior to such appointment being made on the county's at county expense. Obviously, with Measure 5 upon us, we're very concerned that revenues are cut back. In my office, I've already received word that we have a 10% cutback, effectively, in staffing levels into next year. And so we cannot comprehend doing an additional casework, or being able to file an additional number or percentage on these non-supporting contempts than we already do. And so we consider this to be basically an unfunded mandate, or potentially, and understand that it's just for extremely rare cases. The magnitude has not been specified, but I would suggest that it be under a dozen a year or so on an annual basis in any given county that we're talking about, and I think there might be money for that. There is something to be noted in Section 16 under existing law. It does provide that on line 19 and 20, or actually starting on line 18 on page 7, that the court in such case shall order compensation to be paid by the county except when the person so appointed performs the district attorney's responsibility under ORS 25.080. And the court shall order the compensation in those instances, basically, I'm paraphrasing, to be paid by the executive department. So it's really, it's balanced back at the state if it's a child support enforcement case and a special prosecutor's paid. And so it's really under the current law. In this county, we typically have about four or five appointments of special prosecutors in a given year because perhaps a staff member in our office has a daughter, has a child support case, or in some instances we have two women who are after the same obligor who refuse to give their consent to our enforcement against the common obligor on their behalfs. And so there are a few instances where that is currently done, and that's currently paid by the state executive department, not by the county. If there's no further questions on this particular section, I'd move on then to Roman numeral 3 of my testimony about remedies. We just mentioned that we applaud that there seems to be enough inherent flexibility in the statute as drawn, or the proposed bill as drawn, to enable the court to fashion equitable relief that's going to fit the circumstance. And as an example, I would note that courts routinely, some judges, at least in our county, routinely, in the event that there's a showing that that the person, or finding that the person's in contempt, they routinely order the obligor who's unemployed to go out and seek work, to submit a list to our office, say, of the contacts that they've made in an effort to obviously get this person employed and get him paying his obligation. And I don't see anything in the bill that would necessarily prohibit that practice. I'd just like to put on the record that we would think that it's broad enough to include those types of traditional equitable power over the person kinds of remedies. There's little concern over the limitations language in the subsection.
I think you all agreed with this bill.
Well, a lot of it. There's some pretty major parts that we're not taking issue with. But let's focus on those individual ones. They really I think they're more technical than anything else.
Okay.
And on the limitations, the issue that comes up here is that a remedial contempt is deemed commenced when filed and served. And the and served requirement causes problems for the reasons I spoke of earlier. When you have, under present law, an outstanding warrant, if you can't serve the warrant, then that action necessarily fails at 2 years limitations period. And what we're suggesting is that the action be commenced when it's filed, and if that warrant remains outstanding until such person's arrested.
Excuse me?
Yes.
I guess I'm misreading. It seems to me you want to add served in there.
No, we want to delete the and served. There's current language in there that suggests that it be filed and served.
Okay.
We're suggesting that if you have an evasive contemnor who you can't get service on, that he can defeat the action by hiding out.
Okay.
And there are provisions in Chapter 12 of ORS now for tolling provisions when someone, it tolls the statute of limitations when someone's evading. So
I
we're,
didn't
yeah.
understand your writing here.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll move on if there are any no other questions on that point. Okay, as to procedural rules, we have had discussions with representatives of the State Court Administrator's Office. Our only concern is that there are several provisions within ORCP now that do apply to contempt actions. For example, we subpoena witnesses pursuant to ORCP 55. We effect discovery on cases by virtue of ORCP 36 through 44. And I believe that Section 5, subsection 13 is going to basically throw out the applicability of ORCP to these actions. So our caveat here is that make sure we adopt procedural rules that would be concurrently effective with this bill if enacted. We don't want to be in a circumstance where we have a new law and no ability to effect subpoenas or whatever to compel people's attendance into court. Finally, I'm going to, well, not quite finally, but second to last point, I think, I'm going to return, not quite, return to that language on page 4 of my testimony that I alluded to earlier about changing Section 5, subsection 5, and this relates to service and the ability to get a warrant and a remedial contempt. And the suggestion is simply this, that we replace subsection 5 there with the following. The court may issue an order directing the defendant to appear.
Okay, you have that listed on page 4 of your...
Yes, it's
so
highlighted there.
Just flag it and not have you read it right now since we
sure.
aren't some time frame.
Fine.
That is on page 4, sub 5 in bold print of your testimony, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks.
There is a deletion. We think that it was probably unintended. Current law ORS 25020 subsection 3 in the bill, I think that's on page 9, has a parenthetical deletion.
Okay, where, what are you referring to in your testimony now?
Okay.
Are you on to your,
we're
your
on
point number 6?
Yes, point
okay.
number 6, uh-huh.
Okay.
Under current law, we generally file show cause orders that are based on a certified printout from the Department of Human Resources, which essentially by statute makes the prima facie case. And that device is, or that document suffices in lieu of an affidavit. For whatever reason, the drafters of the bill deleted the reference to that particular section that tied in our that document. And we're asking that be restored and that the reference be made, I think it's Section 5, Subsection 4 of the 1991 Act provides that documents can be, let's find it. The person initiating, I'm sorry.
Well, we can find it.
Okay, thank you.
Line 8, page 9, according to your testimony.
No, but the earlier reference is to, let me, if I can just locate it. Section 5, subsection 4 appears, here it is. Yeah, the person initiating a proceeding under this section shall file supporting documentation or affidavit sufficient to give defendant notice of specific acts. So we're suggesting that that record would give though that type of notice.
Okay.
Finally, we would ask to expand the attorney's fees provisions within 107.445. Basically, at this time, there's authority for the court to award a fee, an attorney's fee, to be paid to the county in a successful prosecution of a violation of a restraining order. We're asking that be expanded to also include enforcement of support orders. If we bring a contempt to enforce support, we'd ask that it be allowed a reasonable attorney's fees to be paid to attorney's fee to be paid to the county.
That come off before or after the payment?
Well, we'd probably, that'd be up to the discretion of the judge, and it would depend on the assets, I guess, of the individual. And if they had sufficient assets, I think that they could pay both.
If we're going to do that, frankly, I want a real priority listed specifically.
That's fine. So as to not to prejudice the payment of support, something like that would be a fine way to limit that.
So we'll look at that and getting work to see if the committee wants to do that. Any questions from Carl? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll invite you to be in touch along the way and to sort of work this out. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Ross Shepherd.
Good afternoon. My name is Ross Shepherd. I'm from Eugene. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Generally, I applaud this effort to eliminate some of the complexity in the contempt proceedings that we now have. Lawyers are confused by it, judges are confused by it, and litigants that appear without lawyers are confused by it. My primary concern, though, is contained in Section 5 concerning the lack of the right to appointed counsel for alleged remedial contemnors when they're put in jail for less than 30 days. I question the constitutionality of this process, both on state. I'm certain I can represent to you that it violates the Oregon Constitution as presently is interpreted. I think it may very well violate the federal Constitution. The FEOC case, it's Hicks, XRL FEOC against FEOC, did not address this issue at all. This was a habeas corpus proceeding from the state of California involving a child custody issue. I think Mr. FEOC was the defendant, and he had enough money to hire a lawyer at the trial court and all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So he was never without counsel, having enough funds to retain his own. Under Brown versus Multnomah County, the jail sentence itself is certainly enough indice of a index of a criminal proceeding to require appointment of counsel. Under the federal Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Arjun Singer against Hamlin, decided, I think, in 1972, and in the cases interpreted thereof following, state that in misdemeanor cases, which is a criminal proceeding where jail is the sanction rather than the penitentiary, counsel has to be appointed if the court determines at any point in the proceeding that jail is going to be a possibility. If the court determines at the outset that jail will never be imposed in a misdemeanor prosecution, then counsel does not have to be appointed. But here we have a sanction of up to 30 days, analogous to a Class C misdemeanor in this state, and it strikes me that under the federal Constitution, counsel would have to be appointed at the outset. So I'd ask you to remedy that portion. And I think Senator Bunn made a telling remark in saying that if we give this gentleman a lawyer after 30 days, we can't go back to the beginning and revisit why he was there in the first place. And we take the example of a witness refusing to testify, the witness without an attorney saying, well, I might incriminate myself, or I don't want to tell you what I told my psychiatrist, and I think the law says I don't have to. And then the judge says, testify, or you're going to jail today. And the person says, I'm not going to testify, gone to jail. There are no legal arguments made. And then after 30 days, what good is it for an attorney to come in and try and look at the facts? And what's the attorney going to tell the client? That you got a raw deal 30 days ago. You shouldn't have gone to jail. So an attorney needs to be appointed at the outset. And that would be easy for you to remedy in this bill. It would not increase the cost of indigent defense. There are very few of these cases statewide in any given year, and lawyers are appointed. I believe I can represent to you that lawyers are appointed routinely for indigence when it's so requested. The second point I'd ask you to take a look
can
at.
I was ask you, stop you. Well, how would that affect any child support cases? Sort of generally, generally not something that you deal with, but.
It's not. It's not. Actually, the public defenders only deal with very, very few contempt cases, and they're usually direct contempts. But I think if it's usually the father comes to court and is cited in by the district attorney or even arrested, that if the person Well, if the person's without a lawyer, at that point, the court says, all right, we will appoint an attorney. It's usually a private bar attorney, and the case is put over, and they come back again.
Okay, but we don't want to get ourselves in a position, basically, maybe not, where we're getting court-appointed attorneys for every all of the 8,000 cases or whatever that amounts to that might ultimately be subject to the 30 days. I guess I need to have some concern about that. Or is it just when you actually go to put them in jail after that is when you're saying you have to have a lawyer?
I think you better get another witness for that. Yeah. I just don't know.
I'm a little fuzzy because I think I've lost track of which piece of that we're on.
I know I'm missing something, but as I read, you're talking about the right to counsel in remedial sanction cases,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I see a provision here on line 6 of page 3 that in such situations, the defendant is afforded the same right to court-appointed counsel required in proceedings for the imposition of an equivalent punitive sanction. So it makes the two equivalent, and then you're entitled to a court-appointed counsel on a punitive sanction. The defendant would be entitled to in a criminal proceedings in which a fine or term of imprisonment that could be imposed is equivalent to the punitive sanctions sought in the contempt proceeding. So I'm sure I'm missing something, but it looks to me like you have the same rights that you do in a punitive situation.
I think we need to go up to line 2, line 2 on page 3, and read the initial paragraph. The
defendant is entitled to be represented by counsel.
Yes. A court shall not impose on a defendant a remedial sanction of more than 30 days.
Oh, okay. I'm
affording them the right to court-appointed counsel.
All right. I'm sorry. Okay.
The second...
I understand that. I'm just talking about what they're trying to do here. Okay. Senator Bunn.
Just a clarification for myself. I thought under the status quo that all of these cases currently had counsel available and that this bill limits counsel. It does not expand counsel. So that if we get into a question of what we're doing as far as the budget or anything else, we're not expanding who has indigent defense.
I think that's a correct statement.
Thank you.
The second section I'd like you to take a look at is number 10, which was alluded to by Mr. Linden. We have had discussions about this, and I would ask you to mandate that a judge be removed from a case where it is apparent that there is bias or an appearance of bias or circumstances where a bias activity could be questioned. The public doesn't need that. Litigants don't need that. If a judge has issued an order and an alleged contemnor is before that court for allegedly violating the order, the judge has taken some personal stake in the case. The second judge ought to hear that case to determine what the appropriate penalty, if any, is. So the amendment I would suggest is that the word on line 25, the word may be changed to shall, and the words at any time be deleted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bunn.
What is the status quo now? Are we making a change with this bill from shall to may? Or it's unclear what we're doing today?
It's unclear.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments, Ross? Any questions?
Ingrid, there was a committee. The committee may wish to look at the Wisconsin statute on that particular question because they specifically provide that if the contempt alleged involves disrespect or criticism of the judge, that judge is disqualified from hearing the contempt. It's just a different approach.
Okay.
Madam Chair, how long is the Wisconsin statute in effect?
10 years, I believe. Is that about correct? 9, 79, 11 years.
And with the, we also need to reflect on the fact that we don't have Brown versus Marion County in the state of Wisconsin either. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's real clear. We do get crosswise with that one almost on a regular basis in what we try to do here. or what some people think we ought to be doing here. Qualified some. Anything else? Any questions for Ross? Thank you for helping us refine the policy points, and we'll work with Ingrid, please, on the technical side of things, and then ultimately I think this committee needs to take on. We'll try to identify the major policy questions. I need to get clear in my mind some of the distinctions between how we deal with the child support cases and those kinds of things versus some of the more direct contempt that you people deal with on a regular basis.
Child support certainly is the big issue for you.
Yeah. So we need to sort of make sure we don't inadvertently by this make sure that we have all of a sudden huge costs in terms of defending those cases by every little piece of paper that passes. Okay, anything else? Anyone else who'd like to make comments on Senate Bill 376? Yes, please. And reminding you that we do have another committee that is sort of been diverted to use this room. It's sort of like the airports, you know, the airplanes get diverted to other other landing places. Well, we have, the Labor Committee that needs to find a place to land in a few minutes. So those of you who serve on Labor, you can just sort of peacefully here.
Can't be late to Labor.
Right. That's true. Yes, your name for the record, please.
My name is Paul Saucy. That's S-A-U-C-Y, Madam Chair. I'm here representing the Family and Juvenile Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. My comments will be very brief. I want to advise you that we have been consulted by the committee numerous times throughout its formulation of this proposal, and so they know our position and have incorporated our ideas into it. We agree with the proposal. It's long past due. It needs to be fixed. We like the way they've done it. We've also looked at the suggested changes that Mr. Stecker talked about, suggested by the district attorneys, and we would agree with all of those except for his suggestion about the appointment of special prosecutors. We like the way it is now in the proposal rather than the way he would suggest it. Otherwise, all of his suggestions are good ones, very functional, and they'll work for us. You've indicated, or at least the committee has indicated, that you're concerned about collection of child support. We're the people that are doing it either privately, filing the contempt motions, or are defending the people in the contempt motions. And we feel comfortable with the way the language is proposed in the initial and with the recommendations made by Mr. Stecker.
Okay, then I want to ask you in the ensuing few days or whatever to comment on the whole right of counsel question as it relates to your business and your practice. I think we need to make sure that we have it clear in our minds what the right of counsel, if we change the way the bill is currently drafted to broaden the right of counsel as it's drifted here, and some of us may say the Constitution of Oregon requires, then I'd like you to think about whether it may not have any implications at all. We just need to look at it and make sure that where we go, we know what we're doing.
You may be interested to know how it's handled now, and that is when we file a private contempt and we appear and the judge said, the person who hasn't paid is there, and the judge said, well, if they're going to put you in jail, you're entitled to a private attorney. You're entitled to an attorney. You can't afford one. And usually what happens if the person comes without an attorney, the person filing the contempt, my client, for example, will waive the right to put the person in jail. That way, then, there is no right to a counsel.
So you got a forced waiver of the right to put to jail. It's sort of a limp contempt law.
It's a limp contempt thing, but most, and let me say that it's, let me use the example of it's a mother collecting support. Most mothers don't want to be known as the person that put daddy in jail.
Yeah.
The other big part of the bill is that you've made, and we agree with that, you've made the inability to comply with the order an affirmative defense, which means that the person who is the defendant is required to notify the moving party, the district attorney or whatever, in advance that I'm going to use that as a defense because I was out of work, I didn't have the money, I didn't do this. That gives the moving party an opportunity to gather evidence to show that's not the case, but it also, basically, if they don't put out a defense like that, then you know when you come to court that they probably don't have one and they're going to probably admit their fault, and then we're talking about sentencing versus what are the merits of the case?
Thanks very much. Are there other questions? Thanks very much, committee, for your attention on this bill today, and it's been useful dialogue from everybody. Thanks very much. We are adjourned to furtherance of the Labor Committee.